This podcast is presented by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Enjoy the presentation.
Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is David Vogel, who is the Solomon P. Lee Distinguished Professor in Business Ethics. He is also editor of the California Management Review and professor of political science at UC Berkeley. Of his many publications, two we will be discussing today are Kindred Strangers, The Uneasy Relationship Between Politics and Business in America, and The Market for Virtue, The Potential and Limits of Corporate Social Responsibility. David, welcome to our program.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Where were you born and raised?
I was born and raised in New York City in Queens. I went to Queens College. And I had a professor when I was a junior at Queens College named Robert Engler, who offered some courses on business and politics. And they really kindled what's been a lifelong interest and fascination.
And looking back, how do you think your parents shaped your thinking about the world?
I think they gave me an intellectual focus. I don't think they specifically shaped my views about business and politics, but I think they gave me a love for learning, interest in ideas, and an impetus, I think, to become a professor.
And you said just a moment ago you went to Queens College. What were you majoring in there?
I majored in political science.
In political science.
Yeah.
And Engler, Professor Engler, was he a political scientist or
yeah,
a business?
Yeah, he was a political scientist. I had written a well-known book on the politics of oil. Mm-hmm. And I just got fascinated with business-government relations. And because he was a political scientist, I decided to go to graduate school in political science. And because he was interested in business and government, I decided to focus on business and government. So he had a big influence.
And where along this trail did you pick up this interest, which is also important in your career, of ethical issues? Was that something you got at home? Was it something you got in religious school? Or
It was something that came through being in the business school.
I
began teaching in the area, and we needed faculty to teach in the area, and then I was one of the few people interested in it. And then, as a result of teaching it, I got interested in it and began to educate myself more about it. So it really grew out of teaching
in
the business
school. So this was actually after you had had a position, actually. Here at Berkeley.
Right.
And in graduate school, what was your focus besides business-government relations, or had the bug gotten you by that time?
Yeah, no, it had. I majored in, my specialty was in American politics, and my dissertation was about public hostility to business during the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
So it really was my focus there as well.
And were you very much affected by the times, the 60s? You know, we were on the threshold of the bursting of all these movements, part of whose agenda would be to change the way business does business.
Yeah, no, I was very engaged in, I was very follow those things. I was engaged in some of them. I was interested in some of them, I think generally supportive of them. I had spent a summer working with Ralph Nader on consumer issues. And so the dissertation was an attempt to try to assess their likely impact. So I think they did very much shape my view, and then at time my political views about business government relations as well.
What is it that you bring to the table as somebody who's in a business school but who comes with the skills of a political scientist? Talk a little about that, because traditionally in the past when one thought about business school, we would think of business schools being a place where you learned how to do it, so to speak.
Yeah, I think the high school is quite different in that it's always had a very strong academic focus. And in some ways, being in a business school has been advantageous, I think, for two ways. One is I've learned a lot about business just in terms of teaching and being with students and just being around colleagues who know a lot about business. And secondly, it's given really me the flexibility to focus my research on business in a way which I think would have been more difficult in a political science department, where there's a more emphasis on substantive sub-areas, American, comparative, international, et cetera. So I think it's been very supportive, my colleagues at the business school have always essentially deferred to my standing as a political scientist and deferred to my, the appraisal of my work as a political scientist. So I've always felt the environment was extremely supportive. And I think there are many faculty of the business school whose work, if anything, is even more unrelated to business practice than my work is.
If students were watching this program and they were interested in pursuing the kinds of problems we're going to talk about now, what sort of skills do you think they need, in other words, to do research on business-government relations, which is the field that you've carved out?
I think they need a strong disciplinary background, whether it's in history, political science, sociology, economics, it doesn't matter, but I think they need to come out of a discipline and have a disciplinary perspective, and then they can focus on substantive areas. I think people who just begin with the substantive area are going to find themselves in academic difficulty.
Mm-hmm. How much business do they need to know? In other words, do they also need the training that comes in a business
school? Yeah, I'm not so sure. I mean, I think I've picked up a lot of stuff on my own. I read the business press regularly. I've just learned stuff over the years. I think you can educate yourself in enough business and be open to talk. And also, I run a lot of ideas by past colleagues who know more about business than I do and make sure they're sound. So I think that can be picked up, but I think the disciplinary training is really indispensable.
Is it surprising that as important as business is in this country and in other capitalist country, that there hasn't been as great a body of literature, for example, in political science on this subject?
Well, I think there is a subfield, and if you add up, it's not explicit, but if you add up work on regulation, for example, mm-hmm. And various policy areas, and you looked at work on trade policy, work on multinational corporations and the relationship to government. I think if you looked at a lot of different subfields and add them up, it would look more impressive than it would if you just look specifically at people who do business government relations. So I think actually there is a lot of literature in political science. I think the one area where there's been less work recently is the whole question of business power, business political activity. That I think has not been a major focus. But even there, if you look at the research on lobbying and influencing government, business is part of the interest group literature. Business is seen as a part of that. So I think there's more to it actually than you would think initially.
Of your many publications, one of the books I looked at was an earlier book, I think it's from the mid-90s, called Kindred Strangers, published by Princeton, which is a collection of essays in which you talk about the structural issues in understanding business. And one of the arguments that you're making is that if somebody is looking at American business and its relation to the U.S. government, you really have to look at the history and to understand the uniqueness of this relationship. Talk a little about that and help us understand what is unique about the history of this relationship.
Well, my original interest in that was kindled by my first book called Ethics Ethics and Business, Ethics and Profits, actually, which dealt with the, which was based on a set of meetings with corporate executives in the U.S. And what struck me was the vehemence and hostility they had towards government and government intervention. And so I began to sort of try to think about, why that, where that came from, and then how it compared to those in other capitalist nations. And so
Before we get into that, tell us a little about what this animosity, how strong was it?
And that was in the mid-70s, mm-hmm. and it was basically a sense that we're doing our job and the government messes things up. And there was a sense in which mm-hmm. a real sense of we're running the country, we're important, we contribute vital public purposes, and the government really is a source of intrusion and hindrance. And basically it's seen as a zero-sum relationship.
Right. And so go on. I didn't mean to interrupt you there.
So I wrote a book which summarized their views, and then I try to understand where these came from and what their historical cultural roots were and why they had such different attitudes towards government than was true in other capitalist nations. And so my original interest was kindled by this the different perceptions that business had about the appropriate role of government in different capitalist societies and where that came from.
And you're alerting us to the fact that it becomes very important to look at how in the founding of national corporations, how whether the role of government was as important as
right.
it might have been in other countries.
Yeah, my central argument, I think, was that in America, the role corporations came before big government, mm-hmm. and so government was seen as sort of an after. Sort of an upstart in a way, while in European, other capitalist countries, the opposite was the case. You had a strong state before you had large corporations, and I think that made a big difference. And I think generally, I've always been fascinated by history and read a lot of history, and I think seeing their views in an historical context was quite fascinating for me. And I continue to read. I love to read histories of business government relations. I think it's really fascinating and important.
And this is very different from other places that you've studied in the highly industrialized world, other countries in the sense that government in those places was more of a partner in the original founding.
Right. Though I think if I were to do that now, I think the world looks somewhat different. I think that. Neoliberalism and neoliberal values have become more important in many other capitalist nations. So I think while the government still plays a more important role, the dramatic nature of the distinction is probably a little less now than it was 30 years ago when I wrote that.
The other emphasis in these earlier essays is on the political culture of the United States, the emphasis on individualism and autonomy, which you're suggesting is there and continues to be there and influences the way not only business acts but also the public interest groups.
Yeah, I think there's a sense in which it remains a highly individualistic society, and people want to have structures in which they have a fair amount of autonomy, and I think that, and where the initiative rests within the private sector, including in civil society, not within government, I think that remains very important. I think it's a highly individualistic society. There are some ways in which that benefits business and some ways in which it increases regulations of business.
Mm-hmm. Now, the way we perceive business, especially on the left,
right.
Is one in which it is a unified
right.
Community. It is a community that always gets its way. It's a community that exerts enormous influence. You're suggesting it's a lot more complicated
right.
than that, and most importantly, that it varies over time.
Right. Yeah, I think the key is the varying over time. Now, it is certainly true. We've been in a period for a fair amount of time where business has been relatively influential. But I think if you look back historically, there have been periods when it's the whole argument of fluctuating fortunes, the political influence of business has varied over time. And I think it also varies by issues. And even if you look now, with current issues you're seeing now, say on climate change, companies suddenly very much on the defensive and likely to be forced to support, to have imposed on them some kinds of regulations which they would have otherwise not have preferred. So I think these also vary by issue areas.
Mm-hmm. Now, in the earlier period, you said that that you had to look at questions such as, does business define the agenda? Does business benefit disproportionately from political process? The need for government to keep business confidence, and then the alleged superior capacity of business to mobilize resources. These were several of the factors that you identified
right.
to actually over time explain, well, what's going on here, basically. That is, in terms of their success in realizing their agenda.
Yeah, it's essentially you try to operationalize it. I mean, a lot of what I wrote was within political science, the sort of political pendulum has shifted back and forth. In the 60s and much of the 70s, the dominant view of political science was the pluralist perspective. So my perspective was challenging that in my earlier work, arguing business was more privileged than pluralists had suggested. Then the center of gravity began to switch as Dahl and Lindblom sort of moved to the privileged position business. And then I sort of switched and basically said I thought they had exaggerated the role of business and that the pluralist position was more valid. But I think it's a question of time. I think there are times when the pluralist position perspective makes sense and describes the reality, and there are other periods when the privileged position makes sense. I think it varies a lot over time.
Mm-hmm. A recent guest on our program was Lewis Lapfin at Harper's, and he emphasized in his most recent book the impact of a memo by Lewis Powell for organizing. In other words, Powell essentially was organizing that in the mid to late 70s, business was under attack, right, and that there had to be an organizing effort by the business community in its entirety to respond to this attack. Otherwise, capitalism would really be in danger in the United States. So.
I don't think capitalism was ever in danger in the U.S., but I think there was a serious ideological counteroffensive during the mid-late 70s, which I described in Fluctuating Fortunes, and I think that had a big impact. And I think more generally now, I think that, you know, business has benefited from a change in the culture over the last decade, which has become much more entrepreneurial, much more people are excited about technology, Silicon Valley. Many business leaders are seen as sort of role models, as sort of media stars and stuff. So I think the culture has shifted, and I think the culture is now much more supportive and embracing of business, many aspects of business values than it even was in the late 70s and early 80s when business began to resurge politically.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the issues that you followed quite a bit in both in comparative terms and in the U.S. is environmental policy.
Right.
In this book, there is a long essay on the Clean Air Act, which was one of the defining pieces of legislation that came as a result of the rise of the environmental movement and so on. There was legislation in 1970 and then legislation in 1977. And there were changes there, which let's talk a little about them. Give us a sense of how this piece of legislation really helps one understand the complexity of business environment.
Well, the 70 law was an extraordinary law, acted very hastily in response to substantial public pressure, and turned out to impose much more stringent standards than anyone in the beginning had ever thought were possible. So it was a real example of regulatory, in some ways, overreach, but really showed the enormous strength of public pressure on companies. By the mid-70s, some of the pressure had diminished. Energy crisis, et cetera. The visions in business have become more striking. And the 77 legislation was a much more complicated piece of legislation, which many of the issues involved various sectors of business, for example, Eastern Coal versus Western Coal, fighting against each other. And so it became a much more complicated situation. And the 1990, which I've not written about, but the 1990 legislation under the first Bush administration was even a more complicated story. So the politics became more murky. There's some rollback in 77, but in 90 they sort of rekindled. And I think, you know, if you even think about it through today, although we've had no new clean air legislation now for 17 years, the fact is that the regulations on the book continue to be implemented. And in many ways, at least on automobile pollution, which was the central focus of the 70 legislation, continues to be quite stringent in the U.S. Mm.
And in the case of the automobile admission standards, when there was something of a rollback in 77, you are saying that the key element in this was the fact that the automobile companies were able to create alliances with their unions, who I guess were concerned about the loss of jobs, basically.
Yeah, yes, that was very important. And I think also the intensity of public anxiety over the issue had diminished somewhat. Surveys showed there was less public concern in the mid-70s. But then in the late 80s, mid-second half of the 80s, the poll data shows public levels of anxiety increased dramatically, and the result is a significant strengthening of clean air legislation through the 1990 legislation. Mm-hmm. So I think it's both mobilization and public opinion both matter a lot.
Mm-hmm. So that in or is it the case then that you get a piece of legislation,
right?
Okay, and then the fight continues. So what then are the key variables? In other words, creating alliances, having public opinion on your side, pressure on individual congressmen. How does this play out, and at what point does it actually move to the bureaucracy? And that's where, you know, the fights are as groups come before the regulatory
right.
agencies.
Well, I mean, I think the legislation is the most critical because it sets the framework. I think it, you know, now the more that I think about it, I'm doing some more writing in this area. I think public opinion and public pressure plays a very central role. Mm-hmm. And I think when the public is in a mood or perception where they're willing and eager to have laws enacted that impose more constraints on companies, the government will be more or less responsive. And I think when the public is less enthusiastic, then companies have more room to play. So I think that plays a critical role. When it gets to the bureaucracy, then I think the administration's preferences matter. And the Clinton administration, for example, was always quite ambivalent about environmental standards. It took a long time before they imposed more stringent ones.
And why is that? Is that surprising to you?
Yeah, it's a little surprising. I think Clinton didn't feel there was a lot of pressure. I think he never cared personally about environmental issues. He never thought they were very important and not a priority for him. I think it is surprising that he didn't do more, actually, given being a Democrat. But I think it was part of his centrist more policies, and the areas where he chose to challenge companies, like on healthcare, were different areas. I think he was more hesitant to challenge them on environmental issues for those reasons. The Bush administration also administratively on many areas, actually, I think it's been a very mixed record. But I think, and there's been areas of weaker enforcement, but there have also been areas, actually, particularly on air quality standards, in which there's been a strengthening of rulemaking. So it's a complicated story. I think part of what's happened is that rulemaking has become more technocratic, mm-hmm. More based on cost-benefit analysis, risk assessments. When those assessments and analyses support standards, the government, the bureaucracy seems to be willing to roll along and enact them. When it doesn't, they're more hesitant. So I think the risk assessment and cost-benefit analysis, by making it more technocratic, sometimes inhibits more stringent standards because the government is less vulnerable to public hysteria, but sometimes also can lead to more stringent policies. Mm-hmm. It's a complex story.
You say at some point in here that, and this is in an earlier period, and I'd be interesting if it's still the same, that in comparing Britain to America, you say American environmental policy, the frequent use of prosecution, its insensitivity to the costs of compliance, its centralization in Washington, its reliance on fixed rules and rigid deadlines, its limitation on administrative discretion. Has this earlier description eased up, and what were the factors that in making that happen?
Yeah, no, I think it has eased up. I think intellectual pressures have made a big difference. There's been enormous intellectual critique of regulatory policy as ineffective, too expensive, inefficient. And I think that's had a big impact. I think the declining influence of the environmental movement has had a big impact. Clearly, the Republican control of Congress since 1994 has had a big impact. And on the other hand, Britain has also, the EU has also changed and become actually much more like America, much more centralized. Much more rule-oriented, much more open to public opinion and public pressure. People tell me that my book, National Styles of Regulation, which sort of captured the British regulatory style through the mid-'80s, is now read as an historical piece in a way that people see what it used to be like and how much it's changed under EU pressure. So I think in a lot of ways, the EU looks a lot like America used to look like in the 70s and 80s, and America in some ways looks a little more like Europe was in the 70s and 80s.
And what is this the result of? Is this a consequence of globalization? Or and with that, the kind of internationalization of the environmental movement?
No, because if that were true, you'd expect convergence. But in fact, you're seeing divergence only in a different pattern. Now, I think it's mostly due to domestic political pressures. I think environmental pressures domestically have been stronger in Europe, given the sets of scares and crises and anxieties and regulatory failures. I think, except, you know, we now see, of course, this major concern about global climate change, although which is quite recent. But I think until fairly recently, environmental issues just have become less salient in the U.S. I think people were, the level of anxieties, the perceptions of policy failures had declined. I mean, I'm now writing a book which tries to explain why, in effect, Europe and America have sort of traded places over the last 40 years.
And do you have any working hypotheses that you want to talk about?
I think the demand for regulation is critical. That's the public pressure. And I think, but it's in turn mediated by both political institutions. So the EU's role has played an important role, and mm-hmm. the federal government's importance has played an enormous role. And then it's also mediated by the party in power. So all the things being equal, even if there's if pressure is the same, if you have administrations and governments in power who are from more conservative political parties, which has been true in the U.S., they're less likely to be responsive to those pressures. And I think in Europe, where you've had political governments in power, and the EU itself, which has been more pro-regulation, pro-environment, they're more likely to be responsive. So I basically, my working hypothesis, it's public pressure mediated by political institutions and the preferences of the governing party in power.
Mm-hmm. Which presumably also reflects public attitudes in terms of why.
Not always. Yeah. I mean, I think it's fairly rare, actually, that electoral outcomes are shaped by public concerns about environmental issues one way or the other. I mean, it's quite unusual. So they really don't go in sync.
Mm-hmm. What does, since I read here an earlier work of yours, what does these transitions that we're talking about tell us about your work as a scholar? In other words, how you adapt. Give us a sense of that, how your earlier hypotheses continue to be changed as or reformulated in the context of a world that's really changing a lot.
Yeah, no, I'm constantly, not consciously, but I'm aware of the fact that a lot of my new ideas challenge my old ideas. Mm-hmm. I think in some ways this book actually is to be seen as
one you're working on.
Is it seen as a gloss or an exegesis or a critical appraisal of my earlier work? I think it challenges national styles of regulation by, in a sense, showing that these regulatory approaches have flipped, so that framework, the framework I described there, I think, is no longer true.
Which I quoted you on.
Yeah. I think so. That's interesting. And I also think, fluctuating fortunes. I think I had a vision of the sort of up and down of cyclical view of business influence, and I think, in fact, business has really been quite influential, amazingly influential, for an extraordinary period of time in the U.S. And although fluctuating fortunes argue that the key variable was the prosperity of the economy, the more prosperous, the more people were willing to support controls on business and vice versa. In fact, the 90s, of course, showed that not to be true at all, period of extraordinary prosperity and no increase, very little increase in regulation. So this book really is essentially, a challenge or a revisits my earlier work and argues that some of those arguments, although they were true then, are no longer true.
Mm-hmm. So in a way, you're actually responding to events.
Yeah.
The way things have changed.
Right. The way the world has changed.
Right. Now, what does this tell us about the big thinkers in the social sciences who were influencing your work? In the earlier period. In other words, these grand theories of the way America operates, Hartz,
yeah.
and so on, the distinctiveness of the American
yeah.
culture, the fact that there was no feudalism in the
yeah.
United States. So what I'm
yeah.
curious about is, are they more influenced by context than we thought? You've admitted that you
yeah.
have had to change your thinking.
Yeah.
Do you then have to reassess these?
It's interesting. I mean, I would not want to think that one needs to reassess Hartz. I think there are still fundamental differences between America and, mm-hmm. And Europe. But I think in other cases, I do think that one has to constantly revisit previous perspectives. I mean, if you look at a lot of the literature on comparative regulation, which my work was among a huge portion of literature talking about the distinctiveness of American regulatory style, I think in fact it's no longer as distinctive as it used to be. Mm-hmm. I think that's actually, so that work needs to be challenged and revisited.
And help me understand, why is that? I mean, what is changing in the world that is leading to this convergence?
No, I don't think it's convergence.
Okay. All right, then it's flipping,
yeah.
I guess is what you
in
would
some
say.
Ways in Europe and America have flipped.
Yeah. So in other words, they're adapting features of the other system which emerged out of a distinctive style? Or?
Yeah, I don't think they're consciously adopting each other's
system.
I think they're just at different
events are leading him in that direction.
Yeah. I think it's a complex story as to why the American approach towards regulation has changed in fundamental ways, which I'm still trying to work through. But I do think something fundamental has had began to happen in the late 80s, early 90s, et cetera, which has been quite remarkably enduring. And I think Europe also, largely the role of the EU, I think, the Single European Act in 87, played a very critical role in the rise of green parties in changing European policies. So I think there are specific political and of course in America, the Republican capture of Congress, more or less, since the 94, and the presidency, of course, for the last 8 years. Those, I think, are very significant developments that have had a big impact on each part of the world's approach towards regulation. Now with the climate change pressure, remains to be seen, how America will respond, and America may be a little more convergence on this issue than one would have, than it's been in the past on other regulatory issues. So we'll see how that plays out.
In looking at environmental policy, in what ways has that policy been moved forward by the creation of the community and the European community and so on? In other words, the enormous apparent success in some areas of Europe's responding to the problems of globalization.
Yeah, no, I think the EU has been critical. The EU has a much more pro-regulatory agenda, has had historically, than much of many European countries. The EU, I think, has served as a transmission belt to transmit the priorities of the greener member states to the less green member states, and thus made all of Europe greener. I think the EU has created a vehicle for domestic green groups to do end runs around their own governments to go to Brussels directly. I think the European Parliament is probably greener than most European parliaments. So I think the EU itself has played a very critical role. Now, I don't think there's anything necessary, inherent, that the EU has to have a pro-environmental policy. Mm-hmm. I think I could imagine 10 years from now the EU being having a very different set of values. But up until now, I think the EU seems to be very committed. I think other areas were slowing down, the concerns about regulatory backlash, concerns about red tape. But now the Commission is, on climate change is highly ambitious and aggressive. I think the Commission believes that the new European notion of European soft power, there's an area where Europe can play a leadership role. I think they're partially playing off America doing less. I think there's just a lot of institutional support for this. And I think Europeans, Europe has now become the regulatory trendsetter and the regulatory barometer for the rest of the world. I think the Europeans like that. I think it gives them a sense of their own importance in the world, a soft power importance, which they relish very much as a counterweight to America's sort of hard power in the global economy.
How do you think, or what is your speculation about how this interplay between Europe and the U.S. will play out in pushing environmental policy along for the globe and also impacting the United States? In other words, will we be more responsive to the initiatives that Europe is taking?
Well, I mean, up until now, we've not been. The Bush administration is obviously sort of a little more, in some level moving, not so much to the European perspective, but to an alternative perspective on climate change. Kyoto will be expiring, I think, 2012, and so there's a need to obviously to sort of revisit that. So I think it will a lot depend on the next elections in the U.S., enormously. But I would think if the Democrats... a Democratic president comes into office, I think the chances are quite good that America will participate in some global agreement on climate change. It probably will be less severe than in Europe, but I think it will be much more restrictive, of course, than we have up until now. And I think the other thing which is going on is that the states are becoming very active, of course, particularly California. And that just as in the 60s when you began to get state regulation and companies said, well, we much prefer federal regulation for uniformity, I think that's playing a big role in driving business support for federal controls.
One of the major themes in your work is this question of doing good in the world and getting business to respond to those initiatives.
Right.
Your book, published by Brookings, The Market for Virtue, addresses these issues. And I would like to talk a little about that and then actually pick up some of the environmental issues. At one point, in talking about the United States, you quote Huntington, "In the United States, the single all-perversive ought rampages wildly beyond the control of the is. The result is a unique and ever-present challenge posed by the gap between the ideals by which the society lives and the institutions by which it functions." I think this is in the earlier book, but it struck me as very relevant to the virtue book, because we are a leader in a way in the world in activist groups defining an agenda.
Yeah, I don't think that's true anymore, actually.
Okay. You think it's elsewhere, it's coming from elsewhere?
I think it's very global.
Yeah.
And I think activist groups, NGOs, pressuring firms, are now actually more active in Europe than the U.S. London, I think, has become much more of the center for global NGO activism than the United States is. There's a lot of pressure in the U.S., but I think European NGO activism has really mushroomed in the last 5-10 years. And I think if you look at ethical consumption, fair trade products, things of that sort, demand for them is much higher in Europe than the U.S.
Mm-hmm. Now, the bottom line in all of this, as you point out, is, what we're really looking at is the relationship between ethics and the business of making money, which
yes,
is what
right.
business does.
Right.
And you're suggesting in this book that in a way there is a basic conflict here in how these two things can go together.
Yeah, I mean, the book was written because the dominant perspective on corporate responsibility within the business community and by most academics who study it and professionals in the field is that the two go hand in hand, that you need to do well to do good, and to do good, you will do well. And I think that's very naive and simplistic.
Mm-hmm.
I think you can do good and do well, but I don't think being virtuous is either a necessary or a sufficient condition for being profitable.
Mm-hmm. And so when one looks at the record, and there in your book, you actually analyze questions such as the environment, labor practices, and so on, that I believe you're saying that in a way the results are evident, but they don't have the broad impact within particular companies or across companies that one might think was the case.
Yeah, I think corporate efforts are very uneven. Some is window dressing, some are more substantive. But I think the more interesting question is what the overall impact of the corporate efforts are, not on the companies, but on the problems they're designed to address. And here I think it's very sporadic. Mm-hmm. I think we don't have a lot of good evidence, but the more we study it, the more we see that there are isolated areas which businesses, corporate social responsibility has made a difference, but they're isolated. And there are many huge, important areas where the impact has been quite disappointing.
Mm-hmm. And there are various tools that are employed, voluntary agreements, and so forth. What is the overall assessment of the tools, namely that they don't accomplish what the framers originally intended?
I think the problem is that when the tools seem to make business sense for companies, they can help them deal with risks, improve their supply chains, et cetera, they can work. But when the tools run up against economic interests, when they threaten to impose costs, then I think there are real limits to how they work. So the enforcement is very, private enforcement is very difficult. It was without legal penalties.
And you're talking about now about voluntary agreements, example, to limit the diamond trade and not be buying the diamonds.
Yeah, I mean, these are very hard to enforce. They're hard to monitor without legal sanctions. And, their track record is so that basically will only work if the companies and the suppliers and the consumers, buy into them, sort of essentially really believe in their spirit and find it in their interest to work out. And I think that happens fairly rarely. Mm-hmm. I mean, labor standards is a clear example. The fact is that companies mostly care about low costs and they need to keep their prices down. And that interferes essentially with the ability of their suppliers to treat their workers better. And consumers also, by and large, care about prices and style, not about how products are made. And those are major constraints on, for example, in this very important area, the impact of corporate codes on labor standards. And in fact, there's a growing amount of evidence that those codes, by and large, although they've reduce some of the most flagrant abuses, health and safety, harassment, et cetera, when it comes to areas like overtime, unionization, wages, their impact has been extremely modest.
Mm-hmm. And I think what you're saying, you don't get the best result possible, but the second best basically is better than nothing.
I think on balance, corporate responsibility, it depends on what your benchmark is. Mm-hmm. I think on balance, it has made the world a better place in many areas. Has it made the world a much better place? No. Is it capable of making the world a much better place? Well, maybe at the margin. Mm-hmm. How does it compare to the role of government? Well, I think when you don't have effective state governance, CSR is a good second best alternative. But when you have effective state governance, then that's much better.
Mm-hmm. So what overall here, is it a case that we're getting a lot of symbolic results that may, in fact, make the wealthier activists in the wealthier countries, they don't necessarily wealthy, that makes them feel better about the implications of their own lifestyle, the products they buy, and so on, or is that too cynical a view?
I think there's a little of that, but I mean I wish actually there were more of that. But I think the interest of consumers in so-called ethical consumption is very limited, very uneven, very sporadic. It's confined mm-hmm. to relatively few people and relatively few products. I mean, upwards of, I'm sure, 90% upwards more of the things that we buy and services we consume all day long, we just don't bother to think about these issues. Mm-hmm. And I think that's built into the nature of the market economy. I mean, there are ways we can engage in ethical activity through charitable contributions, through engaging in political activity, et cetera. There are other vehicles we have to express our values. The marketplace on the whole does not seem to be, in most cases, a very effective vehicle for people to express their values, though in principle it would seem like a perfect vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
That you can essentially vote your values every day. And that's, you know, part of the hope and claim of the CSR movement, that they can politicize consumption and make consumption into an arena for political activity. And the reality is that it's very sporadic, and I don't see that changing.
Now, to what extent do the Europeans have a better record with regard to their companies in this regard than the United States?
I don't think European companies are any better or worse. I think I think it's across the board. It's pretty stable. I think you have some good examples in the U.S. and some poor, and some good examples in Europe. I don't think that and some bare examples. I don't think that European firms are on balance any more responsible or less responsible than American firms. I think the pattern is quite similar.
So what is the analysis then of this interplay between activism and the media to make for change? I mean, in other words, at one level, what you're saying, which is analyzing what actually results in,
right,
is offers a somewhat pessimistic view.
I think I'm reasonably pessimistic about the potential of corporate responsibility. I think there are success stories, and there will continue to be success stories. I think they're going to be unusual, sporadic, uneven, isolated. I don't see it as a generic pattern of responsibility. I think if we care about making companies behave better, we need to legally require them to do so. Mm-hmm. And we may, and in some cases we do that, in many cases we don't.
Does this skepticism apply also to the efforts of the private philanthropy that emerges from corporate wealth, and the efforts of individuals such as former President Clinton to work at changing the world by influencing corporations? Are you as cynical with regard to that area or not?
Only moderately less, somewhat less so, but modestly less so. I think some of the initiative, for example, the Gates Foundation on distributing drugs and medical care in developing countries, are very important and consequential. Other cases, it'd be nice to see what it all adds up to. I mean, I think one of the paradoxes of the whole philanthropy and social investment and corporate responsibility and social enterprise movement is there seems to be a lot of input, a lot of activity, but I don't see really much systematic evidence of output. That is to say, show me a particular issue, a problem, an injustice, an abuse, which these efforts have significantly in some measurable way ameliorated. Other than, I think there are isolated areas, but it's still pretty isolated. So I think the verdict is out. I'm skeptical, but I'm open to evidence about these impacts. I think some areas, you know, micro lending, for example, seems to have been quite effective and having a positive social impact. So I think we can point to areas, and I think some of the efforts on global climate change, the voluntary efforts, also seem to be constructive and useful. So I think there are isolated areas, but I think they're atypical.
Mm-hmm. And what you're really saying then, it's really about getting government to
right.
create laws that actually enforce the implementation of these new standards.
Yeah, I think if you look back historically at the U.S., Europe, and you ask, you know, areas in which we have made measurable, substantial improvements in corporate performance, environment, I think, would be one example. Affirmative, treating people, not discriminating against workers, would be another example in the U.S. I don't think there's any question that the key driver has been regulation and policy. Now, once you have regulations in place, then companies can then, you know, exceed those standards. They can make a good faith effort to comply with them. There can be room for private initiatives. But without the bottom line, the minimum threshold set by the state, I think it's very difficult to get lots of companies to make lots of changes.
And can this only happen at the national level, where you have national legislations, or is Europe evidence of the fact that at some mid-level range you can achieve things in the European community? And then what are the implications of that for global regulation?
Well, I think we have some effective areas of global regulation. I mean, ozone depletion, for example, is a very effective area. Some of the other areas, the CITES, the endangered species, whales, et cetera, have been fairly effective global regulation. So I think we have had some areas of effective regulation, but they're few and far in between. And I think the CSR movement has precisely emerged, and the concerns about corporate responsibility have precisely emerged out of a frustration about the inability to have effective global governance of so many areas of labor standards, forestry, et cetera. And therefore, the CSR movement becomes a substitute for effective global state-based governance.
Mm-hmm. So that the effort to achieve something on a global level is less successful, but then you get an impact at the national level, basically, if you get groups organizing within the national polity.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure they get the impact on the national level, but I think these global pressures on firms get firms. Essentially, these corporate codes are essentially private treaties, if you will, mm-hmm. which in principle commit companies to do this and that. And I think, by the way, if you think about it more broadly, the impact of these private codes is probably not much less, better or worse than the impact of most international agreements, human rights agreements, the ILO, also, which are very, tricky, very soft law, very uneven enforcement. I think if you compare, private global regulation to public global regulation, they look pretty comparable. If you compare private regulation to state regulation, then state regulation looks a lot better. It depends on your benchmark.
Mm-hmm. But you are suggesting and mentioning the Bill Gates Foundation,
yeah.
And one can think of Bramson, the head of Virgin, where
right.
there is an idealism motivating one or another corporate executive. But you're suggesting that the real result comes if it's an identifiable area that they focus on to achieve good, then there are greater possibilities there for something.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Gates Foundation is important. I mean, private philanthropy, I think, can play a very important role, but this is not Microsoft, this is Gates. Mm-hmm. So the standard CSR argument is, well, companies will do these things, it'll make them more profitable. But this has nothing to do with Microsoft's profits.
Mm-hmm.
This is really, the Gates Foundation is in the tradition of Carnegie, Rockefeller. They didn't make a business case for corporate responsibility. They were ruthless, profit-seeking people in their business roles, and they took their resources privately and distributed them in very important ways. So I think private philanthropy at that level has played an enormous constructive role. The impact of Rockefeller and Carnegie on American mm-hmm. life, for example, has been extraordinarily positive. And I think, Buffett and Gates can play a similar role. So I think there is, the Ford Foundation, et cetera, is a very important role for private philanthropy. And I think, one of the things which is a little interesting and exciting is the sort of overlap where you're beginning to get essentially philanthropic organizations funding either for-profit or social ventures, which are non-profit but are meant to be financially self-sustaining, like the micro-lending. So you are seeing almost a fourth sector emerging. You have the public sector, the private sector, and then you have the nonprofit sector, and this is sort of the commercial nonprofit center. So the Google Foundation, for example, is essentially giving seed money to support business ventures, which will be financially self-sufficient, mainly nonprofit, but will also be but also have some public impact. So there's a lot of interesting activity there. That's a new development, which a lot of people are very excited about. Mm-hmm. I think it's too early to say what overall impact it will have. I mean, maybe, 10 years from now, I can write a book evaluating its impact. But I think it's an exciting development, but it's too early to say what its staying power will be.
Do you think that the wealth that the entrepreneurial wealth coming out of Silicon Valley and the group that made that money will, beyond what you just discussed, are they distinctive in a way that their predecessors and other corporate fields were not in what you think might be achieved?
No, I think I don't think they're distinctive. I think there's been a long tradition in America of wealthy people who make a lot of money in business and who become very generous philanthropists. So I think that's been a strong pattern in the U.S. I think comes in some ways out of the Protestant ethic, U.S. religious traditions. It's been very strong, and I think it continues. There's a lot more money around now, so of course you can see more of these initiatives. But I don't think it's any historically different than was true in the past. I think Buffett and Gates, et cetera. I think these are very much within the American tradition of people essentially giving away large fortunes.
Do you think that the problem of corruption in business is worse in this recent period than it has been in earlier periods? Because there's obviously a lot of press about that.
Within the U.S. or globally?
Yeah, within the U.S. First of all, within the U.S.
No, I think it's probably always pretty much.
It's there.
The same. Yeah, I think it's always. I think there are always issues, always things you can investigate and be outraged about. I don't think it's much worse or better. I mean, the corporate ethics movement would argue it's better. I'm not so sure it is.
That it's better, that it's worse now?
No, they would argue that there's been progress, companies being more ethical.
Right, right.
I think, I think that abuses, not simply corruption, but simply abuses of consumers, very unethical activity by companies which skirts on the border of legality, such as the lending policies, for example, poor people on mortgages, et cetera. I think that that's those things are kind of ubiquitous. I mean, I think that in a market economy, you will always get some portions of people who will cut corners and take advantage of other people. I don't think that's getting any better. I don't think it's getting any worse. I think that's just the price you pay for capitalism.
So I guess if students were watching this interview and they either were concerned as activists or researchers about ethics and business, my sense is that you would say there are real limits to what reality allows. But the idealism is still worth the effort.
Yeah, because I think that certainly the good news is that there are companies which can be profitable and ethical. I think that's encouraging, and that says a very good message to business students that there is a place you don't need to be corrupt and irresponsible to make money. On the other hand, there's also a large place in our economy, or at least not a trivially small place, for irresponsible, crooked, corrupt, unethical people to also make money. And I think students can make choices. I think so. The good news is students can make choices, but the bad news is that the market system doesn't result in a uniform improvement in business ethics.
Well, on that note, David, which I think it was partially optimistic but partially pessimistic, let me show your book again, The Market for Virtue, which is a good book for people, I think, or students who and others who would be interested in these issues, and it's very helpful in understanding the limits of what can be accomplished. Thank you very much for joining us today, and thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Thank you for listening.